Welcome to 8. We're going to finish up our discussion of Schlesinger and his criticism, which serves as a criticism of Leibniz's best possible world theodicy. We've given an example of a child with very low intelligence, and the best physicians say that an inexpensive operation could restore the child to normal IQ range. Now, to do so, if we did so, the child would be able to experience the great joys that life can bring, the appreciation of art and music, literature, science, communication, and so forth, but will also open up a greater range of potential evils and harms that the child, if he remained in his crib looking at the ceiling for his life, would not have to go through. The anxieties, frustrations, miseries we are at times subject to in this life. The lesson that we learned, I think, is that being very happy is not the main goal of a life that we live, a good life, but rather the goodness of our lives are dependent on the kind or sort of being that we are. So, being good to a person is not so much bringing happiness to that person to maximize their happiness, but also, insofar as it's in our power, we are good to a person if we increase the DDS, the desirability, the degree of desirability of state, DDS, as much as possible in or for that person. Okay, so what we're saying that it's an ethical principle that we can accept, that we should, inasmuch as is within our power, other things being equal, we should seek to improve the desirability of state, the degree of desirability of state in others, in our environment, in our family, our friends, and so forth, as much as possible in those people, as much as it is within our power. But notice now that there is no limit of degree to which the DDS may increase on its own. As you can speak of Socrates and the pleasures of his life, you can also speak of a super Socrates, who is much more intelligent and much more able to enjoy the goods in his life, but on the flip side is also much more able to have pain and suffering in this life than you and me. How then does this relate to God, our Creator? Well, whatever level we could be created at, God could always create us at a higher level. So it's impossible to have a being that will have a maximal DDS or a maximum DDS, for God could always increase that ad infinitum. So another old ethical principle is that ought implies can. That is, if you ought to do something, that entails that you can do something. If it's your responsibility and moral obligation to do it, that entails that you can do it. Now switch it around as well. If you cannot do something, then you ought not to do it. That is, you are not obliged to do it. Since it is logically impossible for God to maximize the DDS, then he is not obliged to bring it about. That's the application of this old treasured principle that I think really brings out the strength of Schlesinger's criticism of Leibniz's best possible world theodicy. The principle Schlesinger hearkens to seems to be a good ethical principle. The first one that we mentioned, namely, to increase the DDS to as much to that level in as much as is within our power. Now, God, being omnipotent, cannot fulfill that obligation, for he could always make it better and better, the DDS level, by making increase to our DDS. God is morally perfect, so it seems that he would make an overall good world. Okay? God's omnipotent, he can't fulfill that obligation, and therefore the old principle that if you can't, then you oughtn't, God as omnipotent cannot fulfill that obligation, therefore he oughtn't to. That is, there is no best possible world, therefore God is not obliged to create it, and that seems eminently reasonable. Just as we defined omnipotence as God's being able to do those things which are able to be done, and not counting it against God that he cannot do impossible things, so, since achieving a maximum DDS is impossible, we should not complain that God has not made such a thing. But since he is morally perfect, it does seem that he would make an overall good world. That is, the overall balance of goods is greater than the overall balance of evils in that world. God could always have made a better world, but that doesn't mean that that ties up his hands if there's no best possible world. It just means that he must create one that's in line with his character and sufficiently in line with the good ends that he maintains in that world. A further obligation we'll have to bring up later is this: whenever God creates a moral agent, a finite human agent like you and I, God has to ensure that each human person, in God's image, after all, has a life worth living, at least through no fault of God's anyway. So the lesson about Leibniz is that there is no best possible world. Leibniz was wrong about that. God's only obligation is to make the world to have an overall balance of moral good over moral evil. Think, for example, of the New Testament, how the Holy Spirit is the restraining force against evil, that God restrains evil in the book of Revelation and 2 Thessalonians 2, 8 and 9. There's also a duty God has to make. It's such, as we said, through no fault of his own, at least, that each person lives a life worth living in his or her earthly existence. I would argue that a part of that moral good that God assures to be in the world is brought about by God's work in the world. God does not stand idly by, but he enters into our suffering and suffers with us. He sends his Son into the world to suffer and die for us. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Can you think of anyone for whom you would do that very thing? Well, we've finished our look at Augustine and Leibniz, and at this point we signal a turning point in our course. We're turning now away from the history of theodicy and the logical problem of evil and responses to it, as well as Hume and responses to Hume, to the evidential problem of evil. Let's review just a bit more of what we've done so far, though, in the course. We started with a basic description of our conception of God and about his relationship to evil as understood in Holy Scripture. Some of our presuppositions of our study and why it's okay to do theodicy were also treated back in the first lectures. 1 Peter 3:15 says that we should have a reason, an apologia, an apology, a defense for the reason, the hope that is within us. So we've been discussing the relationship of God and evil. We went on and talked about the logical problem of evil and how some atheists and skeptics leveled this charge against the theist, namely, that the existence of God is impossible in any possible world in which there exists evil. If you've got evil, then God, if he existed, would have eradicated it, completely abolished it. But then, if you've got evil, it's not possible. That God should exist alongside of it, nor that he should allow it to exist in any possible world in which he exists. I think by reading Plantinga, or someone in the train of Plantinga, after the good work that he has established, and by considering some other reasons, we can rest assured that the logical problem of evil is no longer a real threat to theistic belief. It has been shown by rational argumentation, by conscientious theists like Plantinga and others, that in fact the two propositions, 1, God exists, and 2, evil exists, are not inconsistent. In fact, they are logically consistent. But at this point, we must realize that perhaps it's not enough for the theist merely to show that God exists and evil exists are possible, that they possibly cohabit a world. Isn't it also to some extent, incumbent upon the theist to show, isn't it required of us to give some reasons to think that this world is a world in which evil exists, but is also accompanied by an omnipotent, omniscient, morally perfect Heavenly Father who creates the world and providentially directs the events of the world? Isn't it incumbent upon the theist, then, to give some reasons, to give a theodicy, or at least to give some major inroads as to why God allows evil to exist? Now, it might be helpful at this point to divide the question about evil into 4 separate questions, 4 increasingly difficult questions about God's permission of different types and tokens of different evils. We'll get to those 4 questions in a second, but the reason why we do bring up the 4 is for the fact that the atheist in the evidential problem of evil is going to point his finger at the most difficult of evils and ask for an explanation of the most difficult of these evils. Most difficult of these particular evils. The logical problem of evil never did that. It simply said, why does any evil exist at all? On the other hand, the evidential problem of evil is going to ask a different kind of question, going to adopt a different modus operandi. But before we get to the evidential problem of evil, here's the 4 questions that I just mentioned. 1. Why does God permit any evil at all? 2. Why does God permit the kinds or types of evils that he does? 3. Why does God permit the amount of evil that he does? And under this, the rubric of amount of evil, you can also group, why does God allow the distribution of evil that he does, the intensity, the duration of evils? For example, some evils last a long time for some people, and for others are here and gone immediately. What about the distribution of how evils fall upon us? Before we get to question number 4, it will be the work of William Rowe, especially, that we will focus on. And the main question that seems to be in William Rowe's mind, he's my former professor and mentor at Purdue University, who came up with these 4 questions. The main question in his mind, Professor Rowe's mind, seems to be about the amount question. Why does God allow the amount of evil that he does in the world? But perhaps equally important, and at times seemingly the most important, is this 4th question to him. And it's certainly the sort of framing of his question that he often puts his arguments from evil into. Here's the 4th question. Why does God allow the particular, seemingly gratuitous evils that he does, the cases of horrendous suffering? Now, I hope that you perceived that if you started with question number 1 and then went to question number 2 and 3 and so forth, that as you went along, when you first asked, why is there any evil at all, number 1, and then number 2, why does God permit the kinds or types of evils that he does, and then 3, why does God permit the amount of evil, and 4, why does God allow the particular, seemingly gratuitous, instances of evil? I hope that you perceive that as you go along from 1 to 3 and to 4, that the task of theodicy would become more and more difficult. The task of answering why there is any evil at all is, as a matter of fact, an easier question to answer. Even the free will defense can be given as part of your answer here. But as you go along, answering why God allows the types of evils and the amount of evil he does, this becomes more and more difficult. We enter more and more into the arena of theodicy here. We must also have more of a resolve to answer these questions. And of course, when it comes to the question of theodicy and the problem of evil, we as theists must gird up our loins and be fully ready to be on the defense and the offense. We're playing for keeps here. The problem of evil has been a stumbling block for theistic belief. It is our hope to at least make some major inroads against the argument from evil that Roe has given and that we will now examine. The argument that we now turn to is called the evidential argument from evil. Various scholars, atheistic scholars, have offered this argument as support for rational support, they claim, for the non-existence of God, or justification for belief in the non-existence of the theistic God. One particular argument of note is that by William L. Roe, professor of philosophy at Purdue University. Roe's argument first came out in his article, The Problem of Evil and Some Varieties of Atheism, which came out in 1979, first published in the American Philosophical Quarterly. A year before that, in 1978, in Roe's textbook, The Philosophy of Religion, An Introduction, in 1978, Roe first introduced this argument, which forms the texture and substance of the 1979 article. In The Problem of Evil and Some Varieties of Atheism, Roe produces his evidential argument from evil. To understand what Roe is up to in this article, it's good to get a grasp of two different sorts, two different, actually, particular evils that he has in mind as he gives his evidential argument from evil. Now, this is Roe's first and early presentation of the problem of evil, the argument from evil that he gives. In a number of ensuing articles that followed this one, Roe honed down his argument. He made it more streamlined and so forth. And he also referred to different examples. I've said that he refers to two particular examples. Actually, in this 1979 article, he refers only to one particular evil, an instance of natural evil. An instance of evil which we will call the fawn example, or the fawn's suffering. In a number of his later articles, he refers to another particular evil, a seemingly gratuitous particular evil, which we'll call Sue, or Sue's suffering. To designate these two evils, let's call Sue's suffering E1, short for Evil One, and the fawn's suffering, we'll call that E2, short for evil number two, the fawn's suffering. And once again, in this article that we'll be discussing here, The Problem of Evil and Some Varieties of Atheism, Roe refers explicitly in this article only to evil number two, the fawn's suffering. Now, just as there are many different versions of the cosmological argument, and many different versions of the teleological argument for God's existence, so also there are different versions of the evidential argument from evil. Roe gives simply one version of the evidential argument from evil. And as I said, there are many different ones that one could construct and give. Roe bases his on particular evils. But if you remember the four questions that we introduced earlier in this lecture, you'll note that in question 2, 3, and 4, question 2 had to do with the kinds and types of evils that God, if he exists, allows. Question 3 had to do with the amount of evil in the world that God allows. And question 4 referred to particular instances of seemingly gratuitous evils. By the way, gratuitous, when we refer to a gratuitous evil, that's an evil that occurs, and it's also the case with the occurrence of the evil that there's no outweighing good for which that evil had to occur. That is, an evil occurs and there's no justifying reason for God to have to allow that evil to occur. Or there's no justifying reason for God to allow that evil to occur. If we say it's seemingly gratuitous, if an evil is seemingly gratuitous, we're calling attention to our position as human knowers. We don't know everything, so some things seem a certain way to us. We can look at an event in the world and say, wow, that was evil. And we could say that it seems to us not, that evil seems to us not to be necessary for some outweighing good, some outweighing greater good. In that case, we would say that it's a seeming gratuitous evil. That is, it seems to us. We're not sure, we're not in the know about that, about our opinion, about our judgment. But it seems to us, given what we have to go on, that that evil was gratuitous. That is, that there was no outweighing good for which that evil had to occur. Or, another way to say that is that the evil was a seemingly gratuitous evil, which means that there was no apparent justifying reason why God, or that God, would have for allowing that evil to transpire in the world. Now, before we give Roe's evidential argument from evil, we need to present the two cases, E1 and E2, that Roe will be referring to. Evil E1 is a little girl named Sue who suffers, and E1 is a seemingly gratuitous evil. E2 is the fawn that suffers. And so, we have particular evils, which line up with question number 4 that Roe asked. As you can see, the evidential argument that we're going to look at, that Roe gives and proposes, is going for the jugular vein of the theist. He's going to the most difficult level of theodicy, a call for theodicy, by asking the fourth question. Why does God allow these particular evils to exist if God exists? And so Roe tries to look at and bring to our attention, call to our attention, the worst sort of natural evil, the fawn suffering, and the worst sort of moral evil he can think of, and that's a little girl, a seeming innocent person who suffers at the hands of others. So let's begin first by getting clear on these two cases of evil, upon which Roe will base and rest his evidential problem or evidential argument from evil. So let's start with the Sue case. This is evil E1 that we will refer to in just a bit when we give Roe's evidential argument from evil. So E1, evil 1, is Sue. The Sue case. Now, who is Sue? Well, Sue is a pseudonym for a little girl in Flint, Michigan. This is a true life case. It really happened. A little girl who was beat up and killed brutally on New Year's Eve night, January 1st, 1986. The narrative of the case, according to the Detroit Free Press, goes something like this. This is just a paraphrase of the information that was available. We have a case in which a little girl, 5 years old, suffers. And we also have a number of different relationships to the girl who are involved in the evil at hand. Now, as it turned out, Sue's mother was living with her boyfriend, with Sue's mother's boyfriend. Also, an unemployed man lived at the house, and Sue's mother had 3 children, one of which was Sue, and one which was a 9-month-old infant. Okay, so in Sue's household, there's Sue, 2 of her siblings, Sue's mother, who is living with her boyfriend, and also an unemployed man. On New Year's Eve of that year, 1985, into 1986, all 3 adults were drinking at a local bar near the home. The boyfriend had been taking drugs and drinking heavily. The boyfriend was asked to leave the bar at 8 p.m., and after several reappearances, he finally stayed away for good at about 9:30 p.m.